Please help me welcome our speaker tonight. It's Jane from Chester, PA.
Oh, hi, everybody. My name is Jane. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Jane.
And hi, everybody at home. And, hi. I've been here before. I spoke here before. A couple times, actually. I spoke once in the church and I spoke once out here, but it's been a while. And I definitely different faces. So Shay asked me, Claire called me, texted me last night and asked me if I could do this, and I said, sure, yeah, I'll come out. I had to do some step work and give a good reason to, you know, my girl to jump in the car with me and we do this and drive out here. And I spoke at a conference this weekend and it like wiped me out though, like I'm exhausted. So we're like driving out here and we're like talking about fears, right? But I'm like watching the GPS and we're like doing this. And I like couldn't figure out like the 476 coming off, like if I should go straight, you know? So you kind of like, we're like, oh shit. And then you kind of pull into that like middle triangle where it splits and piss somebody off real bad, you know, behind you. So they're like honking. So I'm like, fuck yeah! And I'm like, that's me coming to an AA meeting to talk, you know, doing a fifth step in the car. So I'm not, you know, some spiritual giant whatsoever. Like, I just flick somebody off on my way over here. So, yeah, that's what you're getting. my sobriety date is November 15th of 2000. I have a home group. It's Ludwig's Corner in Chester Springs. And it's been my home group for about 5 years now. Before that, it was Bud Light in York, PA. That's where I got sober in York. I have a sponsor. Her name is Sammy G. She's from Richmond. She knows she's my sponsor. You know, we talked yesterday. We're very close. I've been with her for a lot of years now. And I sponsor other women. And I do believe those are the kind of things you need to, you know, stay sober, you know. And some other things, too, which I'll get into. But I'll tell you a little bit about what I was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And I grew up in Jersey. My mom has been sober since 1969. She celebrated 53 years in January. And my dad drank. They divorced when I was really young. My mom, even though she was sober, she was kind of crazy, still sober, you know. She married a lot of men and we moved around a lot. And there was a lot of crazy stuff growing up and stuff like that. And but she did the best she could. We all did. And I remember thinking to myself when I was very young and coming to AA as a young girl, right, as a little kid, and like, oh, I'm never gonna drink, Mom. Like, don't worry, you know. Like, I really wanted to be that, you know. But I wasn't like a normal little kid though, right? Like, I always had weird ideas of fun, you know. So like, my friend would be like, let's go play in your lemonade stand, and I'm like, okay. And so my idea was like to set it on fire. You know what I mean? And like, so that's like what I did, you know? And, you know, it's like, let's play with Barbies. And I'm like, okay, let's get naked and have them have sex. You know what I mean? Like, I was always like doing like weird little, like the way that I played was like different from the way like other girls play. You know, we play in my room and like, you know, I stare in the light bulb and like chase the spots. Like, if you stare in a light bulb a long time, you can like get hallucinations. I don't know if you know that though. And like, I would do shit like that. And like, and she'd be like, you know, that hurts your eyes. And I would be like, so? You know, like, so what? You know, it's fun. And so I definitely, you know, was a little different than my friends. And when I picked up my first drink, you know, I was in middle school age. And, by the time I was 16 years old, I pretty much drank alcoholically, you know. So from the time that I was like 12, 13 till I was 16, my disease progressed really fast. And basically that's Partly one of the reasons, maybe too, is because I didn't have a lot of parental supervision going on. You know what I mean? So I had the ability to really be able to go out and do whatever I wanted, you know, all the time. And I would, you know, it was really easy to get liquor. Like, you know, I came from a small town in Jersey, and if you knew the town drunk, you know, you just give him money and he'd go in and get you whatever you wanted. You know, by the time I'm in high school, I'm hanging out with that group of kids that already graduated, but I still hang out with high school girls. You know, that crew, like you might be one of those crew, but you know what I mean. Like those were the kinds of guys I hung out with, and they like taught me how to drink, and they got me my liquor, and we had like, a lot of parties in the woods, a lot of, a lot of crazy, like fun. It was fun, you know, I thought it was fun. And here's the thing, I was like a total slut, and I was totally fine with it. You know, I was like, I'll give you what you want, you give me what I want, and we'll be fine. You know, so I had a reputation. I wound up sleeping with the high school coach, wrestling coach. And back in 1991, 92, when that was happening, the school just hushed it. You know what I mean? When they found out, like it was like today, he would have been arrested. We would have been like on the news. I mean, it would have been a big deal. But back then, it was just like, that shit happened all the time. You know, and I loved having that reputation. I loved being that girl. You know, I wore a black leather biker jacket, and I wore like black cat eyes, and I wore my hair up to here. And if you looked at me, I'd be like, what? Like, you got a problem with me? You know, I thought I was so tough. I did, and I wasn't, but I really thought I was. I really wanted to be. So I barely graduated. My dad, I couldn't really get into any schools, but I went to like Fairleigh Dickinson. I used to call it Fairleigh Ridiculous. I went there and, for like a semester, I think. I don't even know how long. And I remember being in a class and some girl was like, hey, do you party? And I was like, yep. And that was it. You know, me and her started hanging out and that was done with college. You know, that was like my whole college. I couldn't even get in. I think my dad was a professor there, and he like, pulled some strings to get me in like the side building. Like, you're not really ready for college, so like maybe if you can pass this class, you can like go to like the main campus. Like, I was on like that side building. I wasn't like that smart. So, and even then I couldn't do it. So basically what happened was I was, at this point I was drinking a lot, I was doing a lot of other things, and I was at a party, New Year's Eve, and you know, when you're young, there's a lot of people there, you're having a good time, there's a lot of socializing. You know, by this point, I'm at a New Year's Eve party, and it's four of us, and we're playing cards. I'm in Fort Lee, New Jersey, in some apartment building, you know, with a guy named Mike and his cousin Fred, you know what I mean? And then some other dude I don't know, you know? And we're all sweating, we're all paranoid, and this is my New Year's Eve, you know? And I'm perfectly content with playing cards, right? And the guy says, one of the guys looks over, he's like, look, you gotta be cool, my cousin's coming over, he's gotta stop by for something. And you know, we quickly all, you know, try to make it look like we're just a couple people playing cards, you know. And he walks in, and he's got like ripped jeans on, a Metallica shirt, you know, his like arms are like ripped off, you know, like, and he's got like shaggy long hair, and he's a total scumbag. And I'm like, what's up? Because I love me a scumbag, you know. And he's dressed like one at least. But he doesn't drink, he doesn't party that night. And I kind of like him, like, well, look at this guy. And he's like, I gotta work. And I was like, that's kind of attractive, like, you have a job. So I made him believe that I was a nice girl that night, you know. And up to this point, I haven't really had any kind of relationship. I haven't really had a boyfriend, you know what I mean? I had friends, guys that I slept with, but I hadn't really ever been in a relationship. And I didn't really think I really wanted one until I met this guy. And when I met this guy, I was kind of like, wow, I think I like this guy a lot, you know? And by the end of the night, I convinced him that, like, I was a nice girl and that, you know, we should go out. And he was like, all right, you know? And we went on a date, and I went back to his house. He lived with his mom at the time. I think I was like 18, 19, he was like 24. He lived with his mom at the time, and he worked for a construction company, and I went back to his house where he lived with his mom and stuff, and like, I stayed over, man, and I didn't leave, you know, like, I wanted to marry this guy. I was like in love. And the only problem is that, like, up to this point, I have no idea how to be in a relationship. I don't even know how to really have friendships. You know, I have people I party with. You know what I mean? I had my best friends through high school, and I wasn't a great friend. You know, I really wasn't. You know, it's like we could party together, but like if there was some dude or something I wanted that was better or seemed like a better time, I'd ditch you in a heartbeat. I wouldn't even think twice about it. If you needed me, you really needed me, like I might show up if it was convenient for me. You know, but I wasn't a good friend. You know, and so, and I didn't know how to be a girlfriend. Right? And so what I would do, what I proceeded to do was, move into his mother's house, right, without asking him, you know, and I was working at a biker's bar called the Nickel Valley in Paramus. I lied to get the job, and I was a cocktail waitress there and stuff, and I made good money, and I was pretty good at it, but what I decided to do is quit, because now I'm getting married. You don't know that, though, yet, right? So I was like, quit my job so I can, you know, be home for you, you know? And he didn't ask me any of that stuff. You know, this is all me, Jane, running the show, right? And so I quit that job, and I'm waiting for him, man, right? And I don't have any tools in life, right? I know how to have sex, watch a movie, and fight. That's what I'm bringing into a relationship. That's it, you know? I know how to arouse jealousy, suspicion, and fear, what the big book talks about. I'm good at that. If I want to get your attention, if I want to make sure you love me, that's what I'm going to do. And those are the tools that I have going into a relationship. So that's what I do. You know, I get in this relationship with a guy and I slow down, right? So, and another thing I don't know at this time is I don't know that I have a progressive fatal illness. I don't know that I have that yet, right? So I'm thinking, you know, I'm going to slow down because this guy doesn't really drink. He doesn't really party a lot, so I said, okay, I'm going to slow down. I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to use other stuff. But what happens to me is that when I remove alcohol and other things from me and I don't have a solution, I become crazy. That's just a fact, you know? And so I started to, like, sit at his house and wait for him, and my mind starts to go. And I start to create things and make up things in my head that aren't true. And so I would call him, right? And we don't have cell phones. In 92, I'm dating myself for sure. We don't have cell phones, but I'm calling him on his, he's a truck driver, and his, like, they have a CBM, and he gets on, and, you know, and he's like, and I'm like, you know, hey, and then he talked to Billy, and okay, get him, Billy gets on, and he's like, you all right? And I'm like, yeah. He's like, what do you need? And I'm like, nothing. Do you love me? And he's like, are you kidding? And I'm like, no, do you love me? He's like, yeah, I love you. I'm like, when are you coming home? When I'm done. Okay. You sure? Yeah. All right. Bye. I do that 4 times a day. You know, because I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. You know, and I don't know what to do, and I quit my job. So, you know, I'm waiting for him. And then he'd come home from work, and I'd be like, hey, what about me? You know? Do I look cute? Am I cute? Do you love me? Do you like me? You know, and he tries to say all the nice things. Yeah, you're beautiful. Like, you look great. But I can't hear it, see, because I have a disease that wants to kill me, and a disease that tells me I'm a piece of shit, and I'm ugly, and I'm not worth it. So no matter how many things he says to me, I can't hear it. It doesn't matter. And he can never say enough. And because of that, I start sucking the life out of this guy. And he'd say, yeah, you're beautiful. And I'm like, no, I'm not. Yes, I love you. No, you don't. You know? And he would look at me and he'd like, you know, his eyes would dart away, right? Because I'm like, I'm putting the pressure on, right? So his eyes would dart away. He'd start to get uncomfortable. And I'd be like, what? What was that look? I know what that means because I'm a mind reader and I know what he's thinking, right? And I start a whole fight. I tear down our whole fucking life off of a look and of a what. And that's how I am without a drink, without a solution, without any tools in my life. Right? And then we go out. We would go out, right? We'd go out to a restaurant. We went to diners in Jersey back in the day. We'd go out to a diner or something and a pretty girl would walk in and I'd notice her. Right? Because you notice attractive people. Everybody does. It's normal. Right? And then he'd look at her and they'd make eye contact. And then I'm like, oh, they're fucking. Because I've got, you know, my psychic ability starting to kick in, right? And then the next thing you know, I'm dragging her out by her hair. She doesn't know what just happened in her life. She's just having to walk in my space. And he'd look at me like, what's wrong with you? And I'd be like, I don't know. And after about 3 months of that, he's like, you gotta go. You know? I sucked the life out of him. And I was devastated. I didn't understand what happened and what went wrong. Because I loved him. Like, I wanted to have his children. I loved them. But I didn't get it. And so, my solution at that point when he broke, when I perceived that he broke my heart, but what I did was I broke his, you know? And my solution to that was California. So I got in my 82 Honda hatchback and I headed out to San Francisco. And I honestly thought when I would arrive in California that I would be discovered. I really did. I was like, oh, I'm going to be like walking down the street and somebody's going to be like you and I'm going to be like, yeah, me. And they'd be like, come on, I'm going to make you a star. And I'd be like, okay. Like I totally had this delusion that that was really going to happen to me, you know? I wasn't going to work for anything because up to this point I hadn't really worked. I mean, I was a good server. I was a good in the restaurant business and I could bust my ass and make money if I had to. And I could do some extracurricular things on the side and make some money. But like, as far as like dreams and ambitions and working towards stuff and people that really hustle and to try to get those kind of dreams achieved, I wasn't doing any of that. I didn't want to do any of that. You know, I felt like, it should just come. You know, I had an air of entitlement about me that I don't know where that came from at some point. You know, and a lot of blame and a lot of victim, you know. If only this would have happened, if my mom, if my this, if my that. You know, I had a lot of that. And so I spent about 5 years out in the San Francisco Bay Area. I was in Northern California. I was in Humboldt County. I was in Lake Tahoe for a while. I was all over. I traveled with a band. I was up for 3 years, man. You know, I was out of my mind. Out literally, you know, my third eye was open. You know, I saw truth. Then I lost it. You know, you get like sleep deprivation when you're up for that long. You know, you start seeing like the mothership and shit. I mean, it got weird. You know, shit got weird. You know, and you know, I like wrote a novel and like it was just crazy. Like, and I'm glad I'm got all my teeth and I'm glad I'm not dead. And you know, it could have been real bad. I mean, I was in real bad situations and I was in real violent situations. Like, you know, I was I got in trouble with the law, you know, arrested. I went through a lot of that stuff, right? And, you know, and I did some things, man. I turned a 12-year-old girl on. 12 years old. I have a son, I have two kids at 15. I turned a 12-year-old girl on, you know, because I didn't want to get high alone. She was a fucking little girl. You know, I did some bad shit. You know, I gave my dog, I love dogs. I have two dogs. I gave my dog drugs because I thought he winked at me and told me he wanted it. I mean, that's how out of my mind I was. You know? And I'm so grateful I didn't kill him, you know? I would have devastated me. You know? And those are the kinds of things I had to get honest about when I got in here and a lot more, you know? And today I can be free of that because that's not the woman I am today. You know, that's not who I am. Those are things I've done in my addiction that I'm not proud of, but they're still part of the deal. You know, where it takes you. And I came back from California, you know, convinced that I was a drug addict. And convinced I was an alcoholic, but let me tell you something. I was absolutely fine being an alcoholic. Up to that point in my life. Because it still worked. It gave me relief, you know? It talks about in the big book, The Great Obsession of Every Alcoholic is to learn to control and enjoy their drinking. And that was my goal for the next few years, is that I learned to learn to control and enjoy my drinking. You know? But the problem is when I control it, I don't enjoy it. Or when I'm enjoying drinking, I got no control. And that's the truth about the way that I drank. You know? And so I came to Pennsylvania because my mom was moving here. She moved to Shrewsbury, which is like York County. And I was like this, it feels like here, like you just feel like you're in the middle of nowhere. You know what I mean? And I was like, I just moved to the middle of nowhere. And, but you listen, you can draw me in a lab, you can draw me anywhere, man, and if I want to get it in, I'm getting it in. Like, I'm resourceful that way. You know, I get sober and I don't know how to even like pay a bill, but if you drop me in the middle of nowhere, I can hustle. I can get what I need, you know? And so for the next few years, I drank the way that I like to drink. I tried to go to meetings, to the other fellowship, and I was unsuccessful because I was unwilling to take the suggestions. I was unwilling to really do anything to change my life. I wasn't ready. And that happens a lot. I have a lot of people that come in and want to work with me, say they want to get sober. And I'm like, dude, I don't care if you do or not. You know, I'm fine either way. You know, you've got to want this. A lot of people need it. Oh, y'all might need it. But unless you want it, it's not going to work. You know, and you know, and it's really kind of weird to come into a 12-step program and decide not to do the 12 steps. You know, so if you're here and you're kind of on the fence, you know, hey, try it or don't. Either way, it's okay. I hope you don't die because a lot of us die and that's a reality, you know. And, but I have no control over it. Whether you stay, whether you do the steps, whether you decide to do, nobody does. Your family doesn't, nobody. And there's no magic wand, no fucking mothership that's going to come and fix it and save it and make it right. Nothing. You have to do the work, that's it. You know, and on February 5th of 2000, my father died suddenly. We were just talking about that on the way up here, you know, one day he was here, one day he was gone. And I loved my dad, and he was just, he was so gangster, right? He was just the kind of guy that, you know, like, I'd be like, Dad, I just took out a gas pump in San Francisco. And he'd be like, all right, I'll be there at 5. You know what I mean? Like, he would just take care of everything. You know, if I was like, Dad, I just murdered someone, he'd be like, where's the body? You know, he was just that kind of guy. He loved me. He was a morally a good man, but, I mean, his daughter could do no wrong, you know? And when he died, it devastated me, but not outwardly. I'm not an outwardly emotional person. I did not cry. You wouldn't even know it affected me. But what happened to me over the next 9 months is that the way that I drank and used drugs definitely changed. So here I was once this kind of like fun party girl, like you want to hang out with me. I then became like, oh, she's here. You know what I mean? I became like that girl. I became the girl that showed up and I would get drunk and I'd get like mean. And I get violent, and I get very angry, you know, and I would do things that would cause a lot of damage and destruction. And I know you don't see that about me now, and I tell Kim, but Kim just saw a little taste of my little temper on the way up here. She's like, okay, you know what I mean? So I would do this, so I'd get like this, and I was angry, I was pissed, my dad died, I was mad, you know, and for the next 9 months, I proceeded to like drink and drug into to my bottom, and it wasn't a physical bottom. I didn't lose everything. I had a decent apartment. My dad had left me a little bit of money, not a lot, just enough to party really hard for the next 9 months. Buy a leather couch, and that leather couch like went everywhere with me for like 15 years. I'm like, I'm taking the couch. And I put a down payment on a Jeep, not that one, this, because I'm going back, you know, 20 years, but a down payment, so it, like, helped my credit a little bit, right, because my credit was, like, shot, and I was able to put, like, enough money down on something to buy something, and And my last drink, my last drunk, I was ODing and I was terrified. And I was like, I'm dying. And I did way too much stuff. And I got on my knees and I called out to God. And I'll tell you what, I hadn't talked to God in a really long time. I was raised Catholic. I went to we go to CCD right after that, and then we get confirmed, right? So I did all that stuff, and I did it because my parents made me do it. I didn't really get into religion at all when I was young. I was annoyed by it. I was like, I don't want to go, because what I heard and what I saw in my mother, who was very religious, was first of all, you're a hypocrite, and second of all, God only loves good girls. And you're, for one, not a good girl, and I'm not a good girl, right? God only loves people that, like, are nice, you know, and you know, get good grades and don't have sex and all those things. And, like, that's the complete opposite of who I was. So I didn't think, like, he hated me, but I definitely thought, like, I was kind of cut off from that realm of the spirit, in a sense. But that night, I was scared, and I didn't want to die. I didn't want to feel the way that I was feeling because I couldn't get rid of that feeling. And I got on my knees in this room and I was like, God, please don't let me die tonight. Please help me. And you don't have to believe this, but I had one of those experiences where I was shown exactly who I was. Right? I was shown that I was unteachable. I was a bitch. I was mean. I was not a good person. And it wasn't being shown to me in a way that, like, that I should feel bad about myself. It was shown to me in a way to wake me up and to show me, like, this isn't you, but this is who you've become. And I tried to help you and give you opportunities and love you, and you shit on everything I gave you. Because that was how I was. If you said something, you're like, I know. I said I know about everything. I have a 15-year-old son who says that to me. Like 30 times a day now. I love it. You know? And I was unteachable. And I didn't like who I saw, and I wanted to be different. Now, I didn't come out of that experience and struck sober, like, oh, I found Jesus. You know, that didn't happen. I came out of that kind of in a jumping off place. Like, I couldn't live with it, and I couldn't live without it. And I remember trying to drink, and I kept throwing it up. I don't know if that's happened to anyone, but that is a bad place to be when you can't keep it down, right? And then anything else I would do, I get super paranoid, right? I was like, I'm not having a good time at all, right? My last drink was October 23rd. I had a Heineken. I used to love Heineken. I drank half of it and I couldn't finish it because I was getting nauseous. My sobriety date is November 15th because I loved weed. I thought I'd smoke weed forever, man. I'd like smoking with my grandkids and shit, you know. And I was in AA, right? Because I came to AA like soon after October 23rd. So October 24th, I came to AA. And I sat in AA for a while, and I heard about total abstinence. And I thought to myself, I wonder if they need weed. Right? Because you can just lie to yourself. You know, you can tell yourself, it's like natural, man. Now, even if I think it's even harder today. Because now they're legalizing it, and if you got your medical marijuana card, and it's a solution for anxiety. And look, man, I don't judge anybody for anything they gotta do. We all got our journey. So I don't misunderstand that. I know what I can do. That's it. So it was kind of tough, like kind of trying to figure that out. And then I kind of figured out, and I was like, oh shit, I can't smoke weed. I don't think I smoke weed, you know. And yeah, well, you know, you get really attached to all your little paraphernalia too. You know, your little bat and your mom, you know, all your little like cool shit that you like collected through the years. You know, you get kind of attached to it. You know, and you're like, okay, maybe someday, like, give it to a friend. Like, I might come back for that. You know, I never did. So people got some cool shit, but I was like, but then it took me like 4 months to change my sobriety date. You know, because I didn't want to lose that time. You know, just to get honest about that, you know, I would, and then eventually I changed my sobriety date. And in the last 21 years, I've been sober. And I wasn't, if you would have told me my first year of sobriety, I would have made it 21 years. I was like, first of all, I didn't think I would live that till I'm 47. I didn't think I'd live this old. So I was like, I would be like, what? I've had three sponsors in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I came into AA. My first sponsor was really instrumental about teaching me about the fellowship of AA. And she was a really beautiful lady. And she really taught me that women can be kind and nice and not catty, not throw you under the bus, and not try to fist fight you, and those types of things that I was used to, right? And so I started my journey in AA, and I started going to meetings every day, and I couldn't work in the restaurant business because I drank when I worked in the restaurant business, and I knew that. I've had plenty of sponsees and people that come to AA that work in the restaurant business and do just fine. It was just for me that I couldn't do that. And so I got a job. I was unemployable. So for a while, I wasn't working in AA, so I was going to like two meetings a day. I had nothing else going on. York at the time did not have as many recovery houses as we did today. So there's not a lot of young people when I got sober in AA. There was about 10 of us, right? And there was like one hot dude. And I was like, you know, cause you know, I'm a stalker. And I like guys. And that's what I did. So I went up to the hottest guy in the room. Well, I didn't go up to him. I just put myself in his eyesight on a regular basis. Until eventually he asked me out, you know, because I'm slick. And he asked me out for coffee. He was like a year and a half sober. And we started dating. And it's funny, right? I wasn't very sober when I met him. Like, basically when I changed my sobriety date, I was like barely sober. People would say, you know, you shouldn't get in a relationship within your first year of recovery. And I would hear that and I would think that's really nice. You know what I mean? But I couldn't do that. And so when people ask me about it, when I get new people or whatever, I say, you know what, I'm not really the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. I'm like, you can stay sober through anything, right? Will it increase your chances of maybe going back out? Sure will, and it did for me, you know? But I don't really get too into it, so I can't really talk, right? Because I did it. And maybe God put someone in my life to keep me here. I don't know. I don't know if I would have stayed if I didn't met a hot dude. You know? I mean, I'm just being honest, right? So, but I did want recovery. I was at a place in my life where I really wanted something different. I wanted my life to look different because up until that point, I knew what the outcome was. And it was going to be like probably in some trailer park, dead or in jail. Like I kind of knew where I was headed and I wanted a different life, you know? And God had given me an opportunity if I was willing to do the work. So when I got with this sponsor and I started getting into the fellowship, and we did a lot of things in early sobriety, things that I don't know if you guys do this out here, and York kind of stopped doing it too, but we had like dances and we had like, you know, different things. And that shit was fun when you're like 26 years old and you come into AA and your social life is like completely changed. You know what I mean? So we did like a lot of stuff like that. We organized a lot of stuff. I got into this relationship and I did not know how to be in a relationship. Like I told you, I know how to fight, watch a movie and have sex. Like I don't have any skills. And that doesn't change when you get sober. I don't know what it is that we think when we get sober, like our relationships are going to be successful. They're not. They're worse because you can't get drunk, you know? And so, we got into this relationship and it was hard, you know? So I'm going to break this down a couple different ways. I'm going to talk about the relationship, but I'm also going to talk about my journey and recovery, and then I'm going to talk about some other stuff. So I'll first tell you about, I've had three sponsors in AA. Like I said, one taught me about the fellowship. My second sponsor was a guy named Steve F., which some of you guys might know here. You know Steve, yeah. Steve was from Baltimore. His sponsor was Tom Flynn. Those guys would come up to York with their big book, and they would talk big book. And I'd be like, look at these jackasses. Like I was so like these big book thumpers, you know. I didn't like them. I thought they were a little too much, you know. But you know what was happening was I was putting a lot of energy into not liking them, and they were putting no energy into me. And there was something about them, the way they spoke, the way they carried themselves, the way they felt that I wanted. And so I went to him. He actually started sponsoring my boyfriend at the time, and I went to him, and I was like, I'm curious about what you guys are doing. And he said, let me show you. And he started taking me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started having an awakening in this program, right? And I started to see myself. I started to understand what alcoholism was, right? And I started to understand that I had this progressive fatal disease, and that alcohol was my solution, and that without it, I was going to just get progressively worse if I didn't work these steps. So I started to work these steps. You know, and I started to come to believe, and I started to turn my will over. You know, and I just did the actions. I said the prayer. I did the inventory. I did the fifth step. You know, 6 and 7 in the big book is really simple too, right? And it's very intentional the way that it's written, right? You know, it's a heavy step, and it talks about, you know, are you willing to have God remove all these things, and then saying a prayer to have him remove them, right? It's like 2 paragraphs, right? I did that. Right? Now, in that moment, did every single one of my character defects remove? No. But I was just willing to take the action, right? I made amends. I paid off all my financial amends. I made amends to my family the best I could. You know, I started to learn how to pray, asking God, right? Step 11 is tremendous in teaching us discipline and how to ask God for what we want, for freedom. And I started to do those things. And then I started to turn around and help others. And Steve was great at teaching me how to help others. I got on the firing lines. I was on the AA hotline for years. I did the Karen Foundation for 7 years. I did York County Prisons for 10 years. I went down to prisons in Maryland. I traveled all over the East Coast carrying a message. I did a lot of that stuff. And I'm so grateful that I learned how to do it. I'm so grateful I got inconvenienced, you know, for this program. And I got on the firing lines. I met so many people that way. I helped a lot of people. But what happens to alcoholics, and this is really normal, is that our egos get involved. And I started to think I was something in AA. Right? And I started to sponsor a lot of girls. Right? And I started to think, you know, I got something here. And what happens when you... What happens is you start sponsoring girls and you go through the steps, and then these girls go to meetings and you're sitting at a meeting with them, and one of them raises their hand and they say something that you think is so stupid. And I'd look over and I'd be like, I didn't teach you that. Why are you saying that? Right? And an ugliness about me came about this, right? Like that this was about me, right? And eventually all those girls fired me, as they should. You know, because my intentions weren't good behind it. And I really had to relook at the way that I was helping people and what it was about for me. And did I really want to help girls? And did I really want to make a difference? And I really did. I just had to realize that it had nothing to do with me. And that was a process. And I think if we stay around Alcoholics Anonymous, a lot of people go through that process. You know, if you help people, it's not that uncommon, you know. And people can see it from the outside and look at it and be like, I don't like AA because of that. You know, it's just we're all human. We all got ego. We're all trying to do this deal the best we can. And I've learned a lot in AA, and I don't sit around and I judge anyone for where they're at in the program. Because we got this disease that's like a whack-a-mole, right? So we might drink and then we get home to AA and take it down. We press down that alcoholism and we get it in check, right? And it just pops up over here with sex, you know? All of a sudden, we're fucking everybody, you know? And then somebody's like, look at her, she's fucking everybody. And I'd be like, so what? Maybe God just needs to deal with her on that area of her life, and, you know, but you don't need to talk about it and judge her for it, you know? And then you get the sex under control, right? And it pops up with food, and then you're just eating everything, you know? Or you're gambling. Right? I love to gamble. I don't, but I love it. It gets me there. Man, I get off on it. I can only go once in a while, you know, because it's a little dangerous for me. But you know what I mean? Like, you know, when you have an obsession of the mind, you know, it can come out in a lot of different ways. You know, that's why we're treating the whole person. Right? And then you kind of gotta keep doing this stuff and doing this stuff until you don't need to do. You know, you need to seek outside yourself and constantly stimulate. You need something, something, something. You know? And And I believe that's where the 12 traditions can come into play. And Steve had taught me those 12 traditions, and so did my current sponsor. And my current sponsor started sponsoring me because of my relationship. So I'm going to jump back to that. So I started dating this guy when I was very new in AA. I'm trying to keep track of the time here. When I was very new in AA, like I said, my tools going into a relationship and those haven't changed. And then I get pregnant. And we have a baby. His name is Philip. And we have Philip and we're living together and we hate each other. Man, we're fighting. You know, it's like not cool, right? It's not good. It's not a good situation. And I'm like, I'm leaving, you know. And I think one day I'm like, I'm out of here. And I left. Oh, I need to do that. And I got my own apartment. And I moved out. And he was like, wait, will you marry me? And I was like, okay. That sounds like a great idea. And because I wanted a ring. We're fucked up, aren't we? So Steve at the time says, look, I really want you to talk to this lady, Sammy. I think you really need her at this point. Like, you're like, you're in trouble. And I go down to Richmond, Virginia, and I go to her home group, and she pulls me into a back room, and she's like, how can I help you? And I said, well, I don't know, you know, all my sponsors have fired me. I said, with this guy, I got a baby with this guy. And I said, I don't really like him, but we're getting married. I don't know, things are good, you know? And she was like, okay. She goes, well, do you want to be with this guy? I'm like, I don't really know. I don't really know. She goes, well, how about this? I'm going to give you something to do. I said, all right. She said, what I want you to do is I want you to go home. She goes, is he living with you? I'm like, well, no, not really. I said, well, he comes over because, like, we have sex and shit, right? And if he stays more than, like, half the week, you know, then I make him pay. Because you're paying half, right? Right? Because I don't care if it's shit or your feelings. I want your money, you know? And she goes, okay, I got it. She goes, this is what I want you to do. She goes, I want you to go home and I want you to treat this man like a king. And when she said that, I was like, are you kidding me? And she goes, well, just listen. She goes, what that means is she goes, I want you to go home. And she goes, if he stays over, I don't want you to ask him for any money. When the trash needs to be taken out, you take it out because it's your place, because you make that known. And she said, when his cell phone rings, you're not to ask him who's on it. And when he walks out the door, you're not to ask him where he's going. And she goes, and you're not to talk bad about him to his face or behind his back. Because if that is the man you love and the father of your child, then you're going to talk about him with the utmost respect. To him and to your friends, right? Because you know how you get with a girlfriend. That mother, right? She goes, and you're going to listen to him. And you're going to get to know the things he likes, right? And you're not... And you're going to be of service to him. And I was thinking to myself, you got to be kidding me. If I go home and do that stuff, he's going to play me for a fool. And she goes, yeah, he might. She goes, but then it should be really clear about whether you should spend the rest of your life with him then. She goes, but if he's a man about God's business and he's on a spiritual path, he will intuitively pick up on what you're doing and he'll follow, which means he'll let you know who's on the phone. He'll let you know where he's going when he walks out the door. He'll listen to you when you need him to listen. He'll talk about you with the utmost respect. He'll learn about the things you love. And you know what? In that moment, I had a real solution. And I wanted to go home and see if it worked. And I'm not telling you that I went home and did that stuff perfectly, because I am one pain in the ass woman. But I went home and I tried really hard. And I learned how to make his coffee the way he likes it. And I make fun of ice cream at night. I don't know what it is about dudes and ice cream, but they really like it. Okay? And so, just girls, if you want to know. I brought him ice cream at night. And I made his lunches for him every day. And when he came home, I listened to him about his day. And he was a contractor. And I could give a shit about contracting. But, like, I listen, man, right? I started to really listen. I'm like, you know what, I can do that. He's like, you can? He's like, you want to come help me on this job? I'm like, yeah, I'll come. Dude, I've cut drywall. I've hung drop ceilings. Like, I've done siding. Like, I can do shit. Because I listened. Because I felt, I started to learn something that he loved. And we had some good years. We had some really good years. And when I was pregnant with my second son, he said about 11 o'clock, and I was like, I'm going to the garage. I was like, okay, I didn't want to think anything of it. So it was a little late. Comes back an hour later, sits in the couch, he goes, I just smoked crack. Mm. And I was like, oh. And for the next 7 years, we went on a journey that was hard, you know. He got sober for 4 of those years, like off stuff, but his behavior wasn't sober, so he was like spending a lot of money, having affairs, like that kind of stuff. He picked up again, and we got to a point where, it got really bad, and I'm in AA, and I'm doing the best I can, and a lot of people in AA have opinions. They just do, but they all mean really well. But the biggest opinion was leave. But see, when you're in love with someone and you have children, it's like not that easy, you know? Sounds great, but it's not always easy. And my sponsor suggested Al-Anon, and for a little while I went to just Al-Anon. And Al-Anon's beautiful in a few ways, because for one, it didn't tell me to stay or leave. Right? It just got my feet grounded. It taught me how to detach with love, and it taught me how to separate the disease from the man. And I was able to kind of get back to those beginning principles that my sponsor taught me, where I could love him even in his disease, and I could be kind and loving to him while he was going through what he was going through. And when one day I came home, but I had to go because I was suffering from alcoholism and I hadn't picked up a drink. I was like fucking nuts. You know what I mean? You just can't be around that much addiction and in your home like that and not let it affect you. There's, you know, I don't care. You can be the John Wayne of mental toughness. The disease is powerful. And I came home one day and I caught him smoking in the bathroom. And I walked in and I surprised him, right? And he dropped a piece on the floor. And I was like, wait, I'll find it. And in that moment of crawling around looking for that piece of crack, I was like, you have to go, because I'm going to relapse. And I knew it in that moment. And I loved that man. He was the love of my life. I love him. I still love him. He's still out there. I still love him. Because of what I was taught in AA. And all that, even when we separated, I didn't stop my kids from seeing him. I didn't go after child support. I talked about him with love. And I did that for my boys. Because they deserve that. And all through this process, they would go see their dad and they would love their dad. And they would respect their dad. Even when he left them in the middle of the night one night. Even when he took them when he was drinking. He did all that. And you might think, well, you know, you let him do that? And I was like, well, a lot of it I didn't know what was happening. I was being lied to. He had been in AA. You know, there was a lot of more to that story. But what had happened was, they're 15 and 19 today. They're a little bit more smart on bullshit, you know? They get it, you know, they understand a little more. But they love their dad. That is a gift of Alcoholics Anonymous in the program. They don't have to live in resentment and anger towards their father. That's a gift. That's a gift. Because if all I did was talk shit and be mean, I'm essentially letting them know that they're shit too. Because that's half of them. He's half of them. And AA taught me that. You know, and he's out there, actually, somebody called me the other day about him. He's out there right now, and I pray for him, you know. And we talk once in a while, and I say, you know, take care of yourself. And he always says, I'm going to get you money. And I'm like, I know you will, man. You know? And, you know, I moved out here. I got to wrap it up here. I only got a few more minutes left. But that sponsor taught me how to be a kind and loving woman. She taught me how to be an employee. You know, she taught me how to be a friend. Like I said, I wasn't a good friend. And today I'm a lot better friend. I have a certain good friend strength. You know what I mean? You're dying of this disease, I'll be there, you know? You want me to come paint? I might be busy. You know what I mean? Like, I have my limits. You know what I mean? Like, you want me to move? I'm like, I don't know. You need $100, you got it. You know what I mean? Like, I have my strengths, you know? I used to hate baby showers and weddings and shit, you know, and I'd always make an excuse not to go. And I, you know, people would kind of start getting their feelings hurt about it, you know? And then I read this, I met this guy, his wife died, and he said, all she loves to do is go be with her friends at their weddings and baby showers and their milestones in life, and now she can't. And I was like, God, I'm a piece of shit. And now if you invite me to a wedding or a baby shower, I'm going. And I'm gonna be happy about it, you know? So I'm learning how to grow up in this program. I'm learning how to connect, because that was part of my disease. I felt disconnected from you, and alcohol and drugs made me connect. And so I'm learning how to connect sober, you know? I've raised those two boys kind of by myself. I met somebody about 5 years ago, that's why I moved to Chester County. I met him on Plenty of Fish. Yeah. And I thought he was short when I met him. And I didn't really know, you know. I was like, I don't know. And he talked about his kids, right? And I wrote an ideals list. It's a big book telling the story, an ideals list, right? And after my divorce and whatever, I wrote an ideals list. And I wanted somebody who was a good man, who was a hard worker, who got up every day and took care of things, you know. And that was the kind of man he was. A good dad, a hard worker. And I've been with him 6 years now. He gets up every day at 5 in the morning. He works all the way to 9 o'clock at night. Drives his kids everywhere they need to be. Does everything. I was at this conference all weekend, right? And he doesn't come to the AA stuff. Like he just, and that's okay, right? But I was at this conference, and I was on my way home early. And he said, babe, you coming? And he said, he was fishing. He loves to fish. Like, he'll fish for days, right? And he was on his way home from fishing. And he goes, oh, my God, you're there? He goes, wait. He said, don't go in the house until I get there. And I said, okay. And he gets in the house. He's like, I did something for you. I said, what? And he rearranged the whole deck and bought all these flowers and lights and made it into this, like, planty, flowery oasis outside and shit. I was like, oh. So what do you think David did that for you? Like, he's such a good dude. And I'm so grateful that I have him today, you know? And it's only because I've learned to love somebody and treat them with kindness and respect. You know, that I get treated with kindness and respect today. You know, and my 19-year-old graduated and is now at Drexel University. He hasn't picked up a drink or a drug because he's afraid because of his dad. But if you give him a gallon iced tea and put him in front of the computer, you would think he'd smoke crack for 2 days. He definitely has an ism, you know what I mean? And he gets pissed if you separate him from it, you know? But he's a good student and he's a good kid and, you know, he's got his faults, but he's trying really hard. He joined the National Guard and he wound up getting a 3-year scholarship fully paid to Drexel. And my 15-year-old let me know, my 15-year-old is we're praying for him, okay? When he was 11, I caught him with a bomb that he made. The thing was a genius. It was like a Gatorade bottle and like he welded it together and shit. I mean, it was really good. And he was like 11 and he made this. And I knew I was in trouble. And at 14 he told me he smokes weed. But don't worry, he knows he's getting it from good people. You know, and he's kind of on that path and I just pray for him and we try to have an understanding. You know, you keep your grades up and stay in sports. And I'll give you a hard time, you know, and we'll just take it one day at a time. And, but he has a stable home, and there's love in that home, and he knows he's loved, you know. And, I've learned how to be an employee. I'm gonna wrap this up real quick. I didn't know how to be one, and I learned how to be one, and I learned how to fax things and do things that I didn't want to do. I started at $6 an hour, and that $6 an hour turned into 10 and 12 and 14. And you know, I have a career job, and I make good money, and it's not, maybe not my dream, but I've been able to support my kids by myself and give them a good life. And I've had a good life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've learned, I've grown up, I grew up a lot here, and I have still a lot more growing up to do. So I'm going to shut up because I went over a couple minutes, but thank you very much.